All right, I'm here with Mark Shriver for the American Magazine podcast. Welcome, Mark. We're glad to congratulate you on your new book, A Good Man, Rediscovering My Father, Sergeant Shriver.
Thanks very much for having me. It's a pleasure and an honor.
Now, I know a lot of our readers and listeners will know Sergeant Shriver, but maybe to those younger generations who may not know the name as well, maybe you can just kind of introduce him to us.
Sure. I mean, I think he, when he died, got a lot of notoriety for his work in creating the Peace Corps under President Kennedy, for creating the War on Poverty under President Johnson, the creation of programs like Head Start, Job Corps, Legal Services, Foster Grandparents, and also his work with my mom as chairman of the board of Special Olympics, taking that organization around the world, including the International Games in Shanghai a couple of years ago. So what didn't get as much press is his work on interracial justice in Chicago in the early 50s, his work with Martin Luther King there, and his work with the church in integrating Catholic hospitals and Catholic schools, working very closely with Cardinal Strick in that city in the 50s. So all of that it leads to his professional achievements. What spurred me to write this book was really the comments of so many people saying he was a good man, which is different than being a great man. And when I look back and got a sense of what made him a good man, it was, I think, his marriage of 56 years to the woman of his dreams, my mom, the fact that he raised five kids, all of whom love him, the fact that he went to Mass every day, he had a very daily, intense relationship with God. He had countless friends, and somehow he could balance all of those different competing interests. And the book is built on the principles of the three principles, I think, that drove his life: faith, hope, and love. So even though a lot of folks, you know, my age and younger, don't know the achievements of Dad in the 60s and 70s, what really, I think, sets him apart from so many other people that have been hailed as great men or great women is the fact that he was, in the small corners of life, a good man.
Yes, I'd like to talk more about his faith and what you discovered kind of as you grew older with him. But I am interested in some of the historical pieces as well. You write very interestingly of the time that he was called upon to help coordinate the funeral of John F. Kennedy. And at a time when the relationship between Lyndon B. Johnson and Bobby Kennedy was strained. And we've been reading about this. Robert Caro has a new book out detailing a lot of this. So maybe you can share that story a bit.
I think Dad had one of his unique talents was the fact that he could get along with so many different types of people. And as I talk about in the book, when President Kennedy put together his cabinet, the best and the brightest, the person who was the headhunter who was in charge of that effort was Dad. And he knew people that were involved in the civil rights issues. He knew people like Martin Luther King. He also knew Supreme Court justices. He had gone to Yale Law School and had gone to school with Potter Stewart and then Wizard White, who was later to be named a Supreme Court justice. And I think he got along clearly with the members of the Kennedy family. His wife, my mom, Eunice Kennedy Shriver, obviously was a member of that family, but he also got along very well with Lyndon Johnson. I think it was just part of his personality and his ability to work with people. And when the Peace Corps was being created, Dad relied heavily on Johnson's advice on how to structure it as an independent agency, not part of the U.S. Department of State or any other agency. And that was critical to the Peace Corps' creation and its strong work today. So I think Johnson trusted him. And the members of the Kennedy family and the Kennedy administration did as well, as evidenced by the important roles he had in not only assembling the best and the brightest for the cabinet, but the creation of the Peace Corps, and then for Johnson, the creation of the War Against Poverty. And as Johnson laughingly said to him, you can do both jobs at the same time. So he was literally being paid by the federal government to run the Peace Corps and the War on Poverty at the same time.
Yeah, that's amazing. And you mentioned this before, you know, a good man in the name of your book and a great man. What's the difference between those two?
I think a great man or a great woman, you know, gets a lot of credit, has made a lot of money, has the corner office, is hailed in popular press. I think a good man is somebody who is good to the big shots, like the cardinal or senators or president, and treats them the exact same way he treats the woman who serves him at a restaurant, the waitress at a restaurant, or as in my dad's case, not only the waitress at his local restaurant, but the guy at the US Air counter. My dad had a unique ability to really focus on the human being and to treat them all the same, whether they were big shots or little shots, and to take care of people in all walks of life, from his grandkids to his children, even when the camera wasn't on him. A lot of people that are great are really, you know, great in, when the cameras are rolling and when they can make a lot of money or when they can use people to achieve greatness. A good man doesn't do that. A good man or a good woman is the same to everybody, whether they can help their career or not. And Dad was ultimately a good man. He was a great man on the domestic and international stage, but he was a good man on that stage as well as in the home and in the neighborhood, at the gas station, in the church, day in and day out, and that's much harder to do. There are a lot of great men and women that you don't want to have dinner with that aren't good people. You know, you don't want to have a drink or a beer with them. With Dad, you did.
Right. He would seem to be able, and this is a theme of your book, to be both a public figure, you know, he's running for office, he's working for Kennedy, and a really solid family man who was there for you guys. And you really have some great stories about the letters he would write you, you know, just on very personal things. This seems very difficult for politicians to be able to do today, to balance these two things. How was he able to do it?
I think it was definitely his faith. I think the guiding principle in his life was his relationship with God. He went to Mass every day of his life. When we would travel domestically or abroad, when he'd check into a hotel, the first question he'd ask is, do you have the Mass schedule? Because he wanted to go the next day. And I think the fact that he got on his knees every day and acknowledged that he was not God, that he was not in charge, that he needed help, he needed reinforcement and support from God, from the Holy Spirit, from Jesus, that all gave him his energy. And he left Mass every day fired up to enjoy God's grandeur. That meant human beings, that meant nature, that meant big shots and the guy at the corner drugstore. And I think that gave him his balance. It's a unique blend, the fact that he had this incredible energy but could also focus in on the moment. And I think that's what made him really special. And I think his faith demanded, he comes from the Catholic tradition of implementing a call for social justice, of feeding the hungry, of clothing the naked, of housing those that don't have houses. And his mother and father did that work when they lived in Baltimore. And then when they moved up to New York City just before the crash in 29, they were actively involved in the Catholic Church and the Catholic Church that fed the poor. And when you look at, you know, Dad's invitation to Dorothy Day to come up to Yale to speak when he was in college there, he clearly, you know, was attuned to those issues when he was in college, and it was consistent throughout his life. I really think that the hope and love that principles that dominated his life, you see that implemented in the creation of efforts like the Peace Corps, like the War Against Poverty, Head Start, Legal Services. And you saw it in his work in Chicago through the Catholic Interracial Council and his work as president of the Chicago Public School Board, appointed by Mayor Daley. These are all efforts to spread hope and to spread love. And you see it in the creation of Special Olympics. Sounds a little corny, but I really think that those are the three guiding principles: faith, hope, and love. Those are the three guiding principles of his life.
Well, you mentioned that at different points, some people may have seen Sarge, as he was known, as a Boy Scout, or kind of, you know, clean cut. But you say that you kind of, as you were, you know, you got to know him, you see that he was more complex and intriguing than even you thought. Maybe you can speak about that.
Well, I think, you know, he was well-liked, and he had an incredible ability to get along with people. And when he was pitching the creation of the Peace Corps, he visited every congressman and congresswoman and every senator. And he did a, you know, shoe leather door-to-door effort there, and that's one of the reasons the Peace Corps became reality. So people liked him, but he was also incredibly smart. He put himself through Canterbury School in Connecticut, through Yale, and through Yale Law School on scholarships and gifts from family friends because his family had gone broke in the Depression. So he was very smart, very strategic, you know, very cagey about how to get ideas done. But ultimately, I think it was all an ambition to do God's will. It was an ambition to cosmic reality, not necessarily a personal ambition. It was to really implement faith and hope in the as called for in the Gospels. The letters he wrote are fantastic guides for me. You know, he would slip a note under my door in high school and in college, or send me letters after I got married and moved out of the house. I'd get one or two a day. And they were fun letters about the Baltimore Orioles baseball box score the night before, or they were, you know, serious, an article he had read in America Magazine or in Commonweal, underlining the important parts, or a book from Cardinal Lustiger or Henry Nouwen or Dorothy Day or some book that the Pope had written. You know, there were all sorts of different books and different articles. But they, when I reflected back on them to write this book, A Good Man, I really got a good sense, a better sense of what made the man tick and what made him so unique. And it really all speaks back to faith, faith in God, and faith that he was not God and was not in charge, and God was, and to turn that over to God.
And it definitely comes across in your portrait of him that he was a thinking man, an intellectual Catholic. I mean, he was, as you said, at night you would see him, he was reading all sorts of magazines and books.
Voracious reader. You know, you try to sneak in a little late in high school or in college, you know, later than you were supposed to be at home, and the light would be on in his room. You know, he'd go to bed at 10:30 or 11, but he'd get up at 1, he'd read till 3, he'd go to sleep from 3 to maybe 5, he'd read from 5 to 6, and bam, he was at 7 a.m. Mass. Maybe he'd get up at, you know, 5:30 and hit the 7 a.m. Mass in downtown D.C. as compared to the local parish where we belonged, Our Lady of Mercy. And he had an incredible appetite. It ranged from books by Dorothy Day to, you know, Bob Woodward to Elie Wiesel to America Magazine to the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal. And they would all, these magazines and publications would line his bed and he'd read them all night long. He had an incredible amount of energy, probably slept 4 hours a night. And his mind was always on and always fired up to gain more knowledge and to greet the day.
There's one commencement speech, I believe, that you quote from where your father talks about being a servant in service. It was central to, especially when you talk about his work with the Peace Corps and the Special Olympics. One hand, it's always impressive to see how he used the language of faith in his public speeches. But in terms of the question of service and being a servant, is there a lesson there for, you know, politicians today, or also, you know, young people today leaving college?
There's a definite message. There's actually two speeches I'll touch on quickly. One was the 25th anniversary of the Peace Corps, in which he used the line, serve, 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 for in the end it will be the servants who save us all. And that was obviously to the Peace Corps crowd, but he meant it for everyone, that he really believed that our mission here is to serve the poor and to serve those that don't have a voice, whether it's the poor or people with developmental disabilities. And that's why he was so supportive of my mom's effort in Special Olympics, because that was breaking down the walls of discrimination and isolation for people with developmental disabilities. The speech he gave at Yale University, I believe it was in 94, about breaking your mirrors is also a very powerful image, particularly for graduates, for all of us, really. Here was a man who was internally focused as far as his faith and needing help from God on a daily basis, but who always encouraged everyone, my siblings, me, everyone he ran into, to break your mirrors and to stop looking at yourself in the mirror and to stop focusing on how you look, how much money you have, how great you are, and to start looking at your neighbor, whether your neighbor literally is across the street or your neighbor in a foreign country. So the message of serve, 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 for in the end it'll be the servants who save us all, and the message of breaking your mirror so that you stop focusing on yourself and how wealthy America is, how powerful we are, and start really bring some humility and some service into your life is very powerful, not only for today's graduates, but for everyone to hear.
This may be a tough time, I think, for a lot of Catholic Democrats because they're trying to find a home either within the church or within the party, and that can be very difficult. Your father was somebody who was able to do that, and your mom, too, somebody who was, you know, both persons of principle, you know, solidly Democrat, but also solidly pro-life. Is there something we can draw from that? I mean, we can look to their example during these difficult times?
I think the answer to that question, to me, came much clearer when I found a speech that he had given in 1966 at Xavier University at the Alumni Association. And I want to read it because I think it really speaks to the issues of today. And he said, and I quote, "Just 3 or 4 years ago, it was practically impossible for a federal agency to give a direct grant to a religious group. People said that there was a wall between church and state. But we said that wall was put there to keep government out of the pulpit, not to keep the clergy away from the poor. That wall protects belief and even disbelief. It does not exclude compassion, poverty, suffering, and justice. That is common territory, not exclusively yours or mine, but everybody's, with no wall between. And so we said, Reverend Mr. Jones, or Father Kelly, or Rabbi Hirsch, if you're not afraid to be seen in our company, we're not afraid to be seen in yours, because we are all about our Father's business." And I love that quote. calling upon the Protestants, the Catholics, the Jews, and he called upon Muslims as well to do Our Father's business. And the Our Father is capital O, capital F. And I think what he believed and what he was raised on was a Catholic church that reached out to all, people of all faiths, to people that were moved by the Spirit and a call to help right wrongs. You know, the Jews call it tikkun olam, it's to right, to repair the world. And I think that he saw that whether you were a Protestant or a Catholic or Jewish or a Muslim, that if you were interested in doing Our Father's business, he wanted to work with you. And he wanted the government to support that effort. So I don't think he relied and thought that the government should do it all clearly. And I think that that's the Catholic faith that I was raised in, that my mother and father believed in. It's an inclusive faith. It doesn't exclude people for their belief or disbelief or for whatever perceived ability or disability they might have. It's an inclusive faith that reaches out and includes everyone to do Our Father's business. I love that. A guy who was paid by the federal government saying we ought to work together to do Our Father's business.
You write a little bit about your own personal journey and how, especially growing up, there was this kind of, at times, perhaps unhealthy competition or sense of competition you felt with some of your family, especially some of the Kennedy cousins. How did your father and his faith help you to kind of overcome that?
You know, I think every family has its own dynamic, particularly big families. You know, their competition. I think a lot of our competition got played out in the newspaper. And, you know, there was the family was involved in one way or another in a presidential or vice presidential campaign from 1956 through 1980, you know, 24 years, and then really into 84 as well. So there was a lot of that pressure going on. I just think that Dad's presence, the fact that he was there every day, the fact that even when he went on trips, he would send notes, he'd make phone calls, the fact that you felt like he was there, even if he wasn't physically there, you always felt his presence and you knew that going to Mass was important for him. You knew that his relationship with God was important. And I think, you know, I struggled definitely through adolescence. And today still struggle on trying to find a balance. I want to go to Mass every day, but I can't pull it together. You know, I struggle on that one. And I think for a lot of fathers, particularly as we approach Father's Day, that are struggling with balancing faith and family, friends, a job, making a commitment on a national stage or a global stage or in your neighborhood, it's a balancing act. And I hope this book, A Good Man, which really tells the story of how Dad found a few secrets to help keep him balanced, helps other folks, men and women, to be better.
Now, your dad just passed away not too long ago, and he had an extended fight with Alzheimer's. What did you learn from that period and kind of, you know, being with your dad? You said you were in charge of managing some of his affairs at those times.
I managed his legal affairs and his medical affairs, managed the house, you know, for my mom and dad as they got older. But I clearly didn't do it alone. I mean, I've got four siblings that are fantastic and their spouses were incredibly helpful. You know, my brother Timmy and his wife Linda and their five kids live about 5 miles from my folks, you know, about 5 miles from us. And they were huge support systems in there. So it was really a family effort. I mean, I guess I had responsibility from a legal perspective, but that was really the only difference. You know, Alzheimer's is brutal. It really strips the person who you love away from you, you know, day by day. And particularly for a guy that had so much energy and such a big brain, it was painful to see. And I write about, you know, some of the tougher times of dealing with some of the idiosyncrasies that developed during Alzheimer's. And it's hard. It's really painful. You know, as I've reflected back on it after Dad died, you know, I saw that his, even when he was losing control of language, that, you know, in Mass, and if he was blowing his nose, which he did regularly, and it kind of grossed me out at times, you know, he would sit there, stand up when he was supposed to stand up, and then, you know, he'd put his head on my shoulder and say, I love you. And wow, you know, that's powerful. You know, when his mind was fading, he still talked about love, and he still knew the importance of love, and he still went to Mass. And he still smiled at the kids and told them that he loved them. So what I learned is the power of unconditional love and that that really is the root of life. I learned patience, that I don't have enough of it and that I need more of it. And I learned, you know, forgiveness. And I learned that he was in the moment, you know. He didn't know that he had created the Peace Corps or even that he had five kids or that there might even be a tomorrow. He just knew he had you at that moment and he was going to tell you he loved you. And he was going to hold your hand even if it, was filled with, tissues that he had been blowing his nose. And all he cared about was the human touch and the human love. And try to live in the moment is a powerful message that I got from Alzheimer's and through Dad. It's hard. And I find it really hard to not forget that somebody slighted me in the past or that, you know, what I got to do in the future to continue my career. But this is a guy that lived in the moment his whole life, not just when he had Alzheimer's. And that was a powerful message.
Well, you talk, your work today, maybe you could talk about that. You work at Save the Children, Washington, D.C., your former Maryland state legislator. How is your dad's example continuing to shape who you are today?
Well, at Save the Children, we were in almost 200 schools around the country teaching literacy skills to little kids, getting them actually. We have a home visiting program. We now run a couple of Head Start programs in Louisiana that we just started about a year ago. A home visiting program for kids 0 to 5 and an after-school summer school program as well for kids through third grade, making sure that kids can read and are living healthy lifestyles because so many kids in this country are either overweight or obese. And particularly for poor kids that are filling up on cheap, empty calories like pop drinks or chips and processed food, it's an epidemic. And we're providing healthy snacks and reinforcing healthy eating and providing physical activity opportunities for kids after school and in the summertime. So SAVE's been around for a little over 80 years. I run all of our work here in the United States. We have a big international presence. And it's, I think, an effort, I hope like my dad's, to try to right a few wrongs, working with, over 80,000 kids and their families. To try to get them the skills they need educationally so that they can realize whatever the dream they want to do, whether they want to be a doctor or a lawyer or a car mechanic. Education, I think, is the key to lifting themselves out of poverty. So I think that this is a Save the Children is a small step in trying to continue that work, which I believe is really critically important, the work of social justice.
Well, again, the book is called A Good Man, Rediscovering My Father, Sergeant Shriver. And I think this is very, very important to keep his story out there because he was really a remarkable man. So thank you, Mark Shriver, for taking part in this conversation.
Thanks a million for having me. Really appreciate it.